This is Audible.
Eskiboy by Wiley. Read by Hamid Ani Mashaun as Wiley. McVern Etienne as Richard Sr. Indi Okonkwo as Janaea. Miles Mitchell as Flo Dan. Shirai Dutira Robinson as Wretch 3-2. Alexander Theoharis as Logan Sama. Ed Hughes as Scratchy. Max Krupski as John Wolfe. And Ali Epstone as Jamie Collinson. Introduction. I hate bullshit books. I've read a lot of biographies. Most of them are boring. I don't want to put out the same old story. Ah, I grew up on an East London estate. Mans was getting shot every week. Rah, rah, rah. It's no use trying to make yourself look good or better than you are. People know straight away when you're not being authentic. I always say I need everything to be as real as it possibly can be, even if I come off worse because of it. The best books are like films. You read it and you feel like you can see it. You've got to be able to see it. It's stupid to stick to one story. How can anyone have just one story? My sister will tell you I'm four different people. You all know me as Wiley, the wickedest gram MC, jumping on stage going apeshit, popping off on Twitter. There's Richard, the boy following in his father's footsteps, climbing out of his crib to bang on the drums. There's Kylie, the lost kid, the wild child who had to learn how to become a father. Then there's Godfather, the Don who was there at the beginning and is there still. And beyond them all, there's Eskiboy, who I can't even really explain. The boy who likes to help people, but has coldness in his heart, who you probably have to read this to understand. I can't tell these stories on my own. I don't even think it would be my story if it was just me telling it. So you'll also hear from those people with something to say, including my best friends from early, some of the best MCs of today, the people who really know grime music, the people who have taught me something and who I respect, and the people who might know me better than I know myself. This is my life, my highs and my lows, but it's not really about me. When I make music, help the scene, or even do something like this, it's like I'm not alone anymore. It's like I'm doing it for people like me. For people who grew up like me. I'm doing it to help people who are lost like me. Part 1. Richard.
Chapter 1. Growing up. Richard Sr. I lived in Limehouse when I was growing up. I went to school in Bow. East London back then was nothing like it is now. It wasn't the safest place in the world, but it was home. There's a real sense of community. Everybody knew everybody. I mean, I was one of eight, and we had extended family everywhere. I was the only one to go to school in Bow, and that was how I met Kylie's mum. She was the sister of one of my best friends, Junior. So I used to go and see Junior a lot where they lived, in the Isle of Dogs, or what was called the Isle of Dogs back then, and just got to know the family. They used to come over to see my sisters. It went from there. We just met up, really. We got married when I was 22. I was in a band called Tribe at that time. The band was good, but it was a lot of work. We didn't have much money, so we had to make do with what we had. We were booked to do a gig in Gravesend once, but when the day came, we realized we had no car. And these massive speaker boxes. Everyone said, "Nah, we can't do it. We got speaker boxes." But I said, "Yes, we can. Let's just get the train." So we carried the speaker boxes to London Bridge, got everything on the train, carried them to the venue, wired them up, did the gig, and then had to carry them home again. That was how it was. But the shows were electric. Grabbing the mic was commonplace. Everyone wanted to be the best. Everyone wanted to do their thing. Competition was fierce. There was a real energy to the music. I loved it. Then we moved to Kent. The band kept going. Every Sunday, or nearly every Sunday, we'd be jamming. That's all I did. Jamming and listening to music. I liked heavy bass, hard-hitting music. At that time, as a Rasta, it was about dub. It was about reggae. soul, Motown, maybe some New Jack Swing. I listened to a lot of music. There was always music in the house. A lot of tapes, a lot of vinyl, but also a lot of playing. Footsie's dad had a sound system called King Original. There were a few other sound systems that we listened to when we went to dances and that. I was in my early 20s when I had him. It kind of changed me in a lot of ways. Everything started to change when I brought him home. I named him Richard, but soon we all started calling him Kylie. Kylie is his mother's name for him. Might have had a couple of rums. We've got like little nicknames for him as well. My mum calls him Kylie or Cat. For the first few years or so, I kept going with the music. His bedroom was our rehearsal room, or our rehearsal room became his bedroom when we brought him home. My son had his cot in the corner, and that was it. Sometimes we'd leave him in there while we were playing, not loud, you know, and I used to watch him. He always used to listen to what we were doing. Even when he was a baby, he was paying attention. And one day, he climbed out of his cot and came over to the drums and started banging on them. As a child, he was very inquisitive, very sharp, very helpful. He didn't like any form of disappointment. If he knew you were trying to do something, he would help you without even thinking about it. I made a set of headphones at the time. The headphones I was using weren't heavy enough, bass-wise, so I made my own out of some small speakers. I wanted maximum bass, but clean, you know? They were good. They used to make your ears hot. Sometimes I'd catch him with the headphones on, listening along with the music. Or I'd see him touching the keys on the piano, trying to find melodies, trying to find something. Music was kind of our thing, really. The band used to rehearse down in Tunbridge, and I used to take him with me, religiously. And whenever me and his mum had a little fight or something, nothing serious, you know, just the usual arguments, I'd get him and go off to rehearse. It was a nice adventure. That all ended really when I had a disagreement with his mum one day and she threw my guitar out the window. That was a wake-up call for me. I wasn't making any money from music and not really doing anything that was going to get me money in any real way. So I had to decide at a time whether I was going to continue the music or go for a conventional job. I started looking for a job and three came along at once. One was in a lighthouse. It was right at the edge of London by the river, all the way down this narrow road. I got to the lighthouse and met the lighthouse keeper, or whoever he was, and we had a chat. I can't remember what the job was exactly, but I think a large part of it was just sitting in the lighthouse. I mean, it would have killed me. He said, "It seems like you're a little overqualified for this." In the end, I took a job with British Telecom and moved back to London.
Chapter 2. Making Music. My very first memory of music is my dad playing his bass guitar. I think we were living in Kent at that time, and he must have put on a video, probably an old reggae video, a show like Sting or whatever. I remember watching the show, watching the drummer, watching the singer, and watching my dad playing along on his guitar, this heavy reggae bass line. I was interested. Music was always on when I was growing up, at least when my dad was around. I wanted to play too. So one day, my grandparents ordered something big from IKEA or wherever, and they had all these cardboard boxes lying around. I just started banging them, putting them together and banging them. That was the beginning, really. Making a drum kit out of boxes, but I was really young. I didn't know what I was doing, I just liked hitting them. My grandparents let me keep the boxes in my room, and at night I'd climb out of bed and go and bang them until my grandparents came in and told me off. And that was my first attempt at making music. I was like 2 or 3 years old. When I was 5 or 6, my dad bought a real drum kit. I was always in the studio just wanting to copy what I saw him and his mates doing. At that time, he was in a band with some of his friends. Footsie's dad, for example. I think it was his drum kit, actually. But it also had piano, guitars, speakers. They were sick musicians. They'd play little hippie festivals and whatnot. They didn't blow up, but they were good. I was never really properly taught, but I used to pick up the instruments, have a little go on the piano, have a little go on the drums, learning slowly until I could play something on them all. The band used to go to Tunbridge Wells and practice and stuff, and sometimes they'd bring me along, It was all live. I'd just sit in the corner and watch them. But after they'd played for a while, my dad would jump on the drums and say to me, right, go on, show me some chords, kick it, kick it. So I'd play the piano or play the guitar, try and keep up. Music was fun, but it was also supposed to be a form of punishment. Whenever I did something bad, my dad would take me and sit me in a corner, tell me to practice. The first time it happened, I remember it felt like a punishment. After that, it was just fun. Just jamming with my dad. Chapter 3, Fight Night. I don't really have many proper memories of my childhood. I remember living with my nan, being in Kent. But for the early years, not much. I remember school and playing football. I loved football. I've been a Tottenham fan my whole life. I remember being about 5 or 6 at primary school and I'd made a friend who had a little Tottenham shirt with Holston in tiny writing across the front. He was the one who got me into it properly when I was buying my first football boots and that. I used to play as a winger. I knew what to do. Scored a few goals and that. And you know what? I reckon I could have been a pro if I'd moved to London a bit earlier. Because in Kent, I was absolutely a baller. Then you get to London where all the pro clubs are and the kids are just going to be sick, aren't they? What I didn't know at that time was that making it as a footballer is all about who you know and who loves you. It might be because you're the manager's son or you're related to someone that you get those trials for late in Orient. Or you find a coach who'll go to the ends of the earth for you. I went to Gillingham for trials and there were some really good players there. The level of football was high for me, but it's not the same in Kent. Without Chelsea, Arsenal, Tottenham, West Ham, it's just Gillingham and loads of semi-pros. There's no comparison with London, really. Other than football and school, Kent for me was more sounds and sights than anything else, you know? TV especially. Cartoons, sports, computer games. I always knew where the fun was. I remember going to the arcades with my family, playing Street Fighter, Ridge Racer, Streets of Rage, Time Crisis, Outrun, Tekken, Virtual Fighter. I loved the noises from the computer games. I loved everything about them. The first time I got paid, I went to the arcades with about £1,000 and spent it all. And boxing, oh man, I miss all those old fights. Mike Tyson on TV early in the morning, Larry Holmes, Tony Tubbs, Michael Spinks, I think. My nan used to say, go to bed. But I'd just sit there on the floor in our front room and she'd let me stay up. She knew that it meant a lot to me. There were always weird times. I'd be struggling to stay awake but excited that I was allowed to stay up. Sometimes I'd fall asleep on the sofa and wake back up in a panic. But when the fight started, boy, that was the best. One of my favorite childhood memories, Tyson. He was the king. Chapter 4, Ken. My mum's brother Junior was murdered in an argument just up the road from where my nan lived in London. Stabbed twice. The first thing nan did afterwards was move us all to Kent. We were young. We didn't even really know what happened. Junior and my mum were so close, not just in age, but as siblings. And Junior was my dad's best friend. He was the one who introduced them. Kent at that time was backward, like a million years behind London. It was so racist that my sister came home from primary school one day saying that an Indian boy had called her a Paki. I was like, what are you talking about? There were loads of white people here. He's Indian, we're black. We shouldn't be racist to each other. Kent was just too slow for me. In London, there are so many different cultures, so many different people, that race isn't really an issue. Even though I was quite light as a kid, it was hard suddenly being one of the only black boys somewhere. I stuck out like a sore thumb. And no kid should be made to feel like that. It was confusing. Kids shouldn't have to feel different.
Chapter 5. Troublemaker. Janaya. One of my earliest memories of Kylie was when I was really little. Mum was looking after us and had taken us to her workplace in Lewisham. and he was one of those kids who just can't keep still. He was bored out of his mind and moaning that he wanted to leave. Mum, I want to go home. Mum, I don't want to stay here. Mum, how long till you finish? That kind of thing. Then when she wasn't looking, he turned to me. He had a stapler in his hands. He said it was magic, and to see, I had to put my finger in it. And when I did, he bashed it down, and I got a staple stuck in my finger. I screamed the whole office down, and Mum came running. He insisted he didn't know what it was, that he hadn't meant for it to happen. But we did get to go home, so... We always used to play pranks on each other. I was just as cheeky as him, but I'd always end up crying first. He was always causing mischief and he was always a risk taker. I remember we were playing at my cousin's house in Limehouse once, just beyond the basketball courts. What happened was they were doing weights in the garden for money to see how much they could lift. And they said, right, go on then, you have a go. And I beat his friend, so I got some of the money. I don't think he was very happy about that. He had a little knife and started playing the game where you spread your fingers and stab the knife quickly between them, back and forth. He did it very fast and then said I should play. I put my hand out and he started stabbing between my fingers, then went a bit faster and stabbed me in my hand. I don't have the mark anymore, but I remember it. We didn't get up to much trouble in Kent. Kent was basically all white. It's changed a bit now, but there weren't many black people at all in Kent back then. There were a few Asian people, maybe, but that was about it. And it was racist. I used to get quite a bit of abuse, name-calling, things like that, on the streets occasionally, but mostly in school. But they didn't really bother Kylie. He was very popular in school. He was the popular kid. He had a bubbly personality. He was a good character. He could talk to anyone. And I think he started rapping back then, which must have been quite a new thing in Kent. But it was mostly because he was so good at football. The best, in fact. And everyone knew it. It's a bit weird, isn't it? He was good at football, so he was popular. So people didn't pick on him, but they did pick on me. I remember my nan was working crazy hours at the time. She wouldn't get home from work until like 1 or 2 in the morning and was up again at 6 or 7 to get ready to go back. She'd always wake us up in the morning, make sure we got dressed and ate breakfast. And for a long time, she walked us to school together. Then she'd run off to work. I think she was actually supposed to start at 7 or 8, so walking us to school must have meant that she was always late. That all changed when Kylie started playing football. Suddenly, we had 11 different boys ringing our bell every morning like, "Is Richard ready to go to school?" At first, my nan was angry. "Why do these boys keep coming to our house? Tell them to go away." But then she must have realised that we'd be safe walking in together, so she welcomed them in. We'd be eating breakfast, the boys would arrive, they'd come and wait in the hall, and then when we were done, she'd shoo us all out the door.
Chapter 6, Back to Beau. Richard Senior. I was in Kent for 6 or 7 years until I got a job with BT. I moved back to London. Kylie and Janaya stayed with their nan. They were going to school down there, so it made sense that they stayed. I used to go and visit a lot, most weekends or whenever I had time off. They seemed happy for the most part, at least while they were still quite young. But then one day, I went down to see him and he said he wanted to leave. I remember it so clearly. He must have been about 10 or 11 and he was upset. He said, "A kid deserves to be with one of his parents. I have to be with one of you." So I said, "Okay then, get your stuff." Fair enough, I thought, but I warn you, it's not going to be easy. He got his stuff. I put it in the back of the car and brought him back to London. I had no plan. I didn't know how I was going to manage. At that time, I was used to just going to work, coming home, going to work, coming home. I was working strange hours, sometimes away for a day or two. So having to cater for a young man without any backup was kind of hard. Having extended family helped because he was close with his cousins. That was a linkage, really. He was friends with them, and then he got to know their friends. I had to apply for secondary schools. He got into my old school in Bow. I don't think they knew what to do with him. School was good for him because he was starting to meet people like him. People with the same tastes, the same talents, the same drive, and they could put something together. But school wasn't so good in other respects. Music was really the only thing. Music was the only thing for him. It was a difficult time for all of us, but it was when he came to London that he started making friends, meeting people who had the same kind of vision that he had, because they were all school friends together. I was still making music. A lot of my spare time was focused on music, rehearsing, making tracks, or just playing music. He was still interested, and he was beginning to learn a lot for himself from watching me or asking me to show him how. He was a quick learner. Everything from bass guitar and drums to the early computer programs. I had a little setup in a corner and he would play around with that. We still listened to a lot of music as well. A lot of dub, reggae, soul, whatever was hot at the time. I remember playing him Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday and trying to explain what the song was about to him. He was a bit young at the time. He didn't understand it. He said it sounded scary. He liked Golden Brown by the Stranglers and quite a lot of classical music as well. I love Vivaldi, so I remember us listening to that quite a bit. He always used to listen to music a lot as well, independently of me. He just soaked it up. The hardships and struggles at that time were the usual struggles. Money. The streets. Even then, not really being safe. People hustling. There are still people trying to lean on you for whatever reason. But I come from a big family unit, so everybody was there. His uncles, his aunts. There's a lot of respect and love there. He got himself into little scrapes. Imagine just trying to feel your way around, having come up from Kent. He'd have to explore the streets, as it were, seeing what's out there, but I tried to keep him as busy as possible. I didn't want him roaming around. From my point of view, he's always been a caring young man, but obviously you don't see everything that goes on. He would probably give you some darker stories. It was just me and him, and we had our disagreements, just like anyone else. We got into little wrestling matches or whatever, but we would never argue for long. Deep down, our bond had always been about music. We'd listen to music together, make music together, and talk about music for hours on end.
Chapter 7. Moving on. Janaea. We were in Kent together until I was like 7 or 8. It was just me and Kylie and my grandparents. My mum and dad would come and visit after they split up, but it was just us, really. Kylie went through all of primary school down there, but he wasn't happy, or he was happiest when my dad would stay. He couldn't understand why we had to live in Kent when our parents were elsewhere. I wasn't happy either, but I was too young to question it. I didn't know what the alternative would be. It all changed when Kylie was 10 or 11, I think. My dad was visiting, and Kylie just asked if he could go and live with him. He wasn't angry so much, more upset. So my dad said yes, he would take him back to London. I wasn't happy at all. I was crying, shouting at my nan. And she told me, he's a boy, he needs his dad. I remember standing in the doorway saying goodbye to Kylie. He promised he wouldn't be gone for very long. He said that dad would come back for me. So I stayed and he left. It wasn't the same without him there. Even though it was just me and him, we still had someone, you know. I loved my nan, but she was busy and she didn't know me like Kylie. I was lonely. I think I lasted 3 or 4 months. My mum was living in London again and I called her up one day and asked her to come and get me. This was over the school holidays in the summer. She picked me up just like my dad picked up Kylie, and took me to her place in South London, a rough bit of Peckham. I loved my mum, but I didn't like it. And then someone got shot nearby. I moved back with my nan and started primary school again in the autumn. After a little while, my mum came to live in Kent too. She moved in with my aunt, who had a house a couple of doors down from us. My nan actually owned 4 houses on the same road. She ran a respite scheme for parents with disabled children. The parents would go off on holiday and my nan would take care of the kids. I used to go and stay with my mum down the road occasionally, but I always went back to my nan's. I think I was just more used to the routine there. I started going to a local private school for girls. It felt like we were more of a family, although I didn't see all that much of Kylie then. He would visit with Dad, but not very often. Things all changed again when I was about 13. Mum moved back to London, to Shoreditch. I went to visit and really liked it. It was lively, completely different from Kent. My mum said I could move in with her if I wanted, so I did. My mum picked me up and drove me to London. I started at Bishop Challoner on Commercial Road, a couple of miles from my mum's place. It was a shock when I moved back. I mean, we'd been taken to visit, new people there, had lots of family in London, but it was another world. The best thing about it was that Kylie lived five stops down the road. Sadly, I was seeing him all the time. He'd come and stay with us for a bit, or I'd go and stay with him. In Kent, we were set apart, and when we moved to London, we were set apart. We were two young people who'd popped up from the middle of nowhere. But he was finding his feet. The music was beginning to take off, or at least he spent most of his time making music, or with his friends from Bow. Danny, Target, all of them. I knew a lot about music from my parents, and from my dad especially, although not like Kylie. This was a whole new world. That was another good period for us. We all got on, even Kylie and Mum. They didn't even really bicker. That's the thing with them. They're nice to each other most of the time, but then they'll have one huge fight and promise never to speak to each other again. The next day, they'll talk on the telephone and sort it all out. It will never last long.
Chapter 8. Inner City Life. Infants, juniors, college, university, bowl of porridge, served with toast if you like, butter. Can I have a taxi, please? I would not be Wiley had I stayed in Kent. As soon as I moved to London and got into secondary school, everything was just easy. Bo was amazing. All the kids were funny as hell. I wasn't that cheeky myself, I just kept my head down. I liked working, looking back, although at the time, I wasn't sure I did. I had to make a lot of big decisions from early on. I was independent from early on. I wasn't a bad kid, but I was just a bit lost. I was easily distracted. There was a lot of road stuff happening, but I always had respect for human life. I avoided all the street drama, all the running and chasing and beating and stabbing. It wasn't just related to poverty. It was kids with only one parent, kids with no parents, no role models. It was always the kids who went through the deepest shit that had the greatest energy. And they can use it in different ways. They can use it for good if they have someone to show them how. If they don't, it can lead to jail or to violence. Back then, I realized quickly that a loss is sometimes just a loss. If you're caught up in any violence or drama, you think that if you take a loss, you have to go out and get a win. That's the way the world is. But sometimes you have to let it go. Use the energy you have for revenge and channel it into something you enjoy doing. That energy can be cold like ice, and people can get hurt. You just say, nah, I'm not having it, and people go to jail, or people get killed. Or the energy can be hot, and you can succeed. That energy can take you all the way to the top. Don't move backwards, move forwards. Get on with life. Luckily, I found a way to use the energy I had productively.
Chapter 9. Family. Richard Senior. Back in the day, they all used to play a lot of football. This was before the music really took over, when they were about 13, 14, 15. Although there was a time when they were doing a bit of both. Anyway, all the boys used to get together and play tournaments in Poplar. Not tournaments as such, but they'd sort themselves into teams. Your crew against my crew. No mixing. Kylie had a good crew. I remember that Tinchy in particular was very good. They took it seriously too. I remember going down to watch them once and they asked if I'd be the referee. So I said, okay. Walked onto the pitch. A minute later, Kylie commits this terrible foul and says to me, Dad, you didn't see that. Tried to get me to cheat. They were tight at that stage, in pairs first. The formation always came in the form of twos. I don't think I can remember anyone that was a solo act first thing. It would have been strange. People weren't solo acts back then. First in twos, most of the time, and then a crew. Friends, football, but for him and his friends, music as well. The music was quite a bonding experience. Like with football, they're all tight, but quite welcoming to new people, actually. If you could spit, you were picked up by someone. The bigger the crew, the better the crew, the bigger the following. And the following also had a lot to do with where you lived. So for us, we were supporting anyone from E3. That was someone who was from the ends, you know, an E3 soldier. Kylie was always encouraging. He'd push people to take the mic, he'd listen, and if he thought they were good, he'd bring them in. Even if they weren't good, he'd find something for them. Organizing dances, DJing, helping with white labels. The nice thing with all of this, the friends, the football, the crews, was that it was like we were a big family. Everyone knew each other in one way or another, either through family or friends. I mean, I was still friends with a lot of the guys I went to school with. They all lived in the area. And we were very close with our neighbors and knew a lot of people nearby. I knew everyone's parents, you know? That's the thing of it. If I didn't know your parents, I knew your uncles or aunties. If I didn't know them, I knew your brother. If I didn't know your brother, I knew your sister. If I didn't know your sister, my brother knows your sister. All of Kylie's friends I knew in one way or the other. Danny Weed, Scratchy, Target. Kids you look out for. And the kids wouldn't just see each other at school or at football, but at christenings, weddings, big family parties, everyone would be there. Family is important. We have a big family, so we know everybody. From my age, going right the way down to my youngest brother. And that's how it was with the music. The same relationships continuing.
Chapter 10. Wild House. I came to the game with knowledge and brain. I came to the game with anger and pain. The game. We came from the ashes. It wasn't a war zone, but it was a bad place. Young people getting stabbed, people getting robbed, people with guns, people hustling, selling drugs, you name it. It was a kind of ghetto life if you want to look at it that way. I'm from a council estate. I know what milk tokens are. The area's changed a lot now. I think now it's really calm compared to what it was back in those days. The dynamics of the place have changed. There are different people coming into the area now, in Hackney and Shoreditch, Canary Wharf and Tower Hamlets in particular. But back then, Bow was a place where things happened. People would come and hang about, buy drugs, just stand around and chat, especially around Roman Road Market. You had the youth centre, you had food, you had the trainer shop, DC's. If there was ever any beef or arguments, people would go straight to Roman Road Market because they know they'll be able to find certain people there. Back then, you couldn't really sit around on your own. There was a lot of peer pressure and no one to ask for help. My dad looked out for me, tried to keep me out of trouble. But when you reach a certain age, you stop listening to your parents. Our teachers didn't really understand us. At school, it was do it this way or nothing. Not all of us were cut out for exams and university, so we had to just do our thing. Saying that, there was the occasional teacher who'd pay attention, who'd spot something. Teachers who believed in raising people up rather than trying to tick the boxes. Someone who can listen, even on the bad days. That's what we needed. Someone to listen on the bad days. We lived in Bow, but used to spend a lot of time around there. Poplar, Stratford, Limehouse. Limehouse in particular. Limehouse was my cousin's area. But they used to call it Wild House, or like Wild Out, because of me. Interlude. Nan, I am London. What's going on, Nan? You alright? Yeah, it's Kylie. What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, I know, Nan. I know you always tell me to come out of London, but I can't. I am London. Ask London. I'm the grime kid. 19 for the first 79. I'm still alive with more in store for the music stores. I'm hyping on a mic tin. All day, we can spit all day. To the end, I'm riding. The next 10 years like a baby smiling. After them 10, give me a black card. I fly around the world, buy two black cars. Too swift, too quick, can't see me, arse. I'm powerful, and I got a powerful past. I'm London, I get praise and abundance. Have you ever wondered why I've never blundered? A few slip-ups, otherwise I'm underground. I'm so London, everything London. Ask anybody, any place, anywhere, if Eskiboy represents London. I am London. You get what I'm saying, then? I'm out here. I'm doing this thing. Hold tight my uncles. Hold tight my granddad. You know what else, Dan? Listen. Yo, I'm the best in Bo, and the rest should know. I'm the best thing since sliced bread. They can't test me, Nan. I'm the champion, so I suggest they run before they're dead. In this game, there's no time for mishaps. No time for Kit Kats, copper and lead. I don't see why everyone thinks it's a joke that I nearly ended up dead. Nan, see the bars I write? They got meaning. Can't test boy better know, they're dreaming. Man might bust his head off the ceiling. When I'm in a race spraying bars, I don't cheat, I deserve the wheeling. When you hear the name Grime, Nan, I am the meaning. I brought my whole team in. And now it's a reality. There ain't no more dreaming. You get me, Nan? They're saying my name. Like thousands and millions of people are saying my name around the world, Nan. That must be a good thing. I know you're proud. Esky boy. Chapter 11. Lost Boy. Listen, people do not change. They get new ideas. They get new friends. They learn new things. But who you are is who you are. If you're a humble person, you'll stay that way. If you're wild as a child, then that's who you're going to be. Apples don't fall too far from trees. You're given one brain and that's it. You don't get a new one as an adult. I haven't changed a bit since I was a kid. This story is quite obvious. My dad is the man. I'm the kid. My mum and him split up, and they both went where they had to go. My mum had to leave London when we were very young because she was going through some stuff. Her brother was stabbed to death. She probably hated London. I'm lost. I'm at my nan's until one day I come to London. And the first day I came to London was the first day of me being Wiley, basically. I never really saw what Kent was about. All I did was play football and then go back to the house. London was always in my head, so I never got that deep into it. I always felt like I was waiting for someone to come back and get me. So when I got back to London, I was like, right, this is my place. I was born there. I'd go all the time to play with my cousins, so I knew that was where I was supposed to be. My earliest and most important influence was always my dad. He was the strongest figure for me to see, and it's because he made me know that he was my dad. Even though he wasn't there every second, I thought about him all the time. I imagined what he might say, so whenever I went to try something, I would practice what I saw him do. I wanted to be just like him. When my dad came and got me from Kent, it was just me and him. Then maybe a year or two later, he'd met someone new. It was a girl he'd always known, I think, but it was around that time they started seeing each other properly. It got serious and she got pregnant, and then they had my brother, Cadell. It was good, but at the age I was, I couldn't really see it for what it was. Every time my dad was around her place, I just thought, oh, so he's around there. He ain't coming back. He doesn't care about me. You know when you're young and you're just angry? I hated her. Not in a bad way, but more because it's my dad, isn't it? I didn't want my dad to be with some woman in her house. It's a jealousy. But as I got older, I wanted him to be with a woman. I just wanted him to be happy. I don't want him to be sitting on his own. I'm not a fan of step-parents. I'm not a fan of them at all. My mum had one or two boyfriends, but I never really friended up with them. Whenever that happened, I just went back to my nan's house. My mum didn't really understand. She was like, what do you think is going to happen if two people split up? Are they going to stay single forever? Do you know what I mean? They're going to move on and find somebody that makes them happy, and that's that. Me and my mum are very similar. I feel at home when I'm in the middle of nowhere. And I got that from her. She couldn't sit still. She couldn't stop moving. She was going through a mad thing. Can you imagine? You've lost your brother at 19 and you've just had a baby. Having me and losing him came very close together. She didn't want to be around all those bad memories. She just wanted to get out.
Chapter 12. The Patty Factory. Richard Sr. When Kylie was about 15 or 16, I set up a catering company with some of my friends. We made Jamaican patties. We hired a unit in Poplar Business Park, bought a load of machinery and got started. The patty factory, we called it. We did it all ourselves because I was an electrician. I wired it all up. We had this huge oven the size of a room that kept breaking down. I had to climb in and fix it. I wanted Kylie there to help, to bring him into the business. Janaya too. This is when they were still at school, so they'd come in on the weekend over the school holidays, especially in the summer. There's always work to do. We'd run it round the clock pretty much. Go in at night and cook the filling, then roll out the pastry in the morning. We were making thousands of patties a day. It was getting quite big. Selfridges were stocking them. Harrods were stocking them. But we didn't really have the cash flow or the people to build it up, so we relied on family, on friends to come in and help. We had a whole crew at one point, Danny, Target, but I had to fire them. They would throw my food around, mess about, not turn up. I think they had a flower fight once. So I'd fire them, but they needed the money, so they'd all come back, remorseful and saying sorry. And I'd take them on again, fire them on a Friday, and they'd be back at work on Monday. They helped out, don't get me wrong, but I don't think they ever really liked it. Kylie in particular, he'd turn up late, go home early. When my back was turned, he used to put his feet up, pretend that he was the boss. This was when he was, what, 16, 17? The music was beginning to take off, but I thought working with me was a more sensible option. And then one day he just said to me, "Look, Dad, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to stick with music." So I looked at him and I said, "Well, God go with you then." And that was that. The end of his only proper job, really. He's been making music ever since. Chapter 13. The Devil's Music. Richard Sr. Wiley's got it. There's a thing we used to say. You don't necessarily need to play. You just need to understand what you're hearing and put it in some sort of order. Similar to the punk thing as well, because a lot of punk, early punk, they weren't really fantastic players, but they had something. They had the energy, the spirit. They went out there and they performed, and that's very much the same as these guys. Very rarely would you find someone who's like a proficient player. The best music is always ahead of its time. It'll always go through a period of the public not liking before they start to like it. When jazz first came, people said it was the devil's music. Now it's an industry standard. But when it first came out, what are they blowing these horns for? How come they're using those? What's going on? You know? And I think any genre of music that paves the way, whether it be drum and bass, garage, dubstep, has to come from somewhere, and it has to involve someone using their creativity.
Chapter 14. Dubplate. My dad is all about music. That's his thing. And that's what's so unusual about us lot as well. Our parents love music, and our parents played music. Our parents all knew each other through music. It was kind of what connected everyone. Their generation passed on a lot to our generation. For me, at least, I'm doing what I'm doing because of them. He gave me the gift. They paved the way, and we've reaped the rewards for their work. Maybe we've gone further because now it's easier to become someone with less work. Do you know what I mean? It's not about playing instruments and singing. You can make a little tune and put it out yourself and have people pay attention. We owe a debt to them though. Not only our parents, but all the 70s, 80s reggae people. Tipper Irie, Smiley Culture, whoever, bro. These guys, we grew up listening to a lot of dub tracks. Dub was kind of what made us who we are. My dad always used to say, "I'm a roots and culture man. Anything that sounds good to my ears and to my heart." When they started out, they all used to go to youth clubs. Everyone would come from different areas, Bow, Poplar, wherever, and try and get on the mic. Everyone knew who was good and everyone knew who was up and coming. But you had to have bars. If you asked for the mic and didn't have any talent, you wouldn't get the mic again. End of. The good people would get the rewinds. They get noticed. That's how it was with dancehall, with ragga, and with reggae back in the day. The whole confrontation thing was exactly the same too. Back then, if you jump on the mic, you got to prove who you are. He couldn't talk nonsense or just make something up. The bars that he was spitting were actually true. You had stories. That was really the start of emceeing, or emceeing as we understood it to be. That culture also fed into jungle. Jungle knowledge is important. Jungle was kind of the first music that we felt could be ours, or that we could be a part of. It was all happening in the early 90s or up to 1995, 96. I just moved back to London with my dad, so I was around 13, 14, 15. A lot of people were into it. D-Double-E, Terror Danger, Footsy, Slimzy. Getting decks, getting on the radio. Slimzy and me went to the same school and we'd get the same bus home. I knew he DJed. And around the time, I was getting into music myself. I remember having a conversation with someone else from school about him. They bigged him up. And it turned out he lived across the road from me. So one day, I went round to his house and asked if I could see his decks. He had all the hardcore selection already. And that was the music that was like clubbed into my brain at that time. Fully. So I was gassed. I was like, oh my God, I know that ragga tune. I was really excited about any jungle tracks which had a little ragga sample or a hip-hop sample. I used to love that and had a lot of it. Back then, it was all about the scene. There was a proper scene and we were all trying to get into it. But we were all kids, really. We loved it and they obviously showed appreciation to us for loving it. But we weren't really in it. Jungle kept it tight. Like they didn't care about major labels. They don't jump up for man. They weren't gassed about anything. They were feet on the floor people. You can't just go in jungle and bust one tune and go clear. Didn't really work like that. You had to keep going and keep going. I respected them for that. Most other scenes are really disposable. That was the start in a way. It was the first time I realized that we could do this. We didn't really need anybody else. We had decks, we had the mic, we had the radio. Didn't need to wait for anyone, impress anyone, push anyone. Just us.
Chapter 15, Kylie Part 1. Richard Sr. and Janaea Cowie. We lived in a pink block, Clare House, next to Victoria Park.
A few things happened around there.
Come on, we live in London. Things are always happening. But you know, it wasn't that bad. It was mostly kids running about, like they always do. Kids getting up to mischief. My dad always used to say, manage your friends. Manage your friends. In other words, you're my friend, but it might not be a good idea for you and me to hang out. I know what you are, and you definitely know who I am, but we're still friends.
Yeah, you see that part of it a lot. Friends can often cause trouble.
He could head it off, though. He's very open and very upfront and very direct. He's an honest person. He says what he thinks. There's no pretense at all. That's maybe why he takes things to heart so quickly. Like on Twitter. If someone says something negative, he'd act as if somebody's walked up to him and said it.
He's not as bad as he used to be, though. He's beginning to change as he gets older. He's getting used to it, or he can brush it off in a way that he couldn't before. And he is a little more careful about what he says, too. He's wary of offending people.
I think what he's starting to learn at this age is that everyone is entitled to their opinion, but that opinion doesn't always need to be heard. Sometimes it's being too open or too opinionated that can get you into trouble. It's sensible, but it's a shame in a way. I think that if you're an artist, when you're dealing with this music, you've got to be able to take whatever is coming. So if you're giving it and I'm giving it, it's like boxers. They go in the ring to hurt each other. They don't go in the ring to play. But afterwards, there's chances of them saying, well, yeah, good fight. You understand?
I think people said it was violent only because of the clashing part of it. That and the police. But there are only a few incidents that really got into a fight, do you know what I mean? He might clash with someone, but they're friends the next day, you know?
Yes, it never lasts long.
There's always some friend. You would get a phone call and they would be like, yeah, you know, duh, duh, duh. You didn't really want to hear that. I remember being with him in Manchester and someone rang him. I think it might have been Westwood because they'd heard he'd been killed, been stabbed to death. So he started messing with it, letting his phone ring. He was getting ready for a show. Obviously, more people are ringing now because they can't get hold of him. And then they start ringing me. He's dead. And I was saying to them, no, he's not dead because he's sitting here with me. I don't know what happened. Someone put it on the old BBC website. They hacked the website and they put it on there.
I always worried about him. Not so much now, but back then I worried all the time. I remember going to one gig. I think it was Sidewinder maybe. And he's on stage with Titch and everyone. I go backstage, standing behind them on the edge of the stage, if you know what I mean. And I suddenly realise that something's happened. They look a bit rattled, a bit roughed up. And then I look at him and I see blood running down the back of his leg. He's been cut, but he was still doing it. So when it comes to heart, I don't think there's too many people that have got as much heart as him.
Part 2. Kylie. Chapter 16. Snare. I grew up with live music. That's why I'm quite surprised I've turned into a computer bot. I could make a whole song from nothing, whether it's just instruments or whether it's sequences. We had to make something different. But my dad says he can recognize his music in what we make. He says he can hear himself. The drums are a big part of it. The snare, he always says. If you listen to any song from back in the day, it's the snare that makes it. The snare is important in Graham. It's part of our identity. I always wanted to be an artist, a performer. I'd watch Bob Marley or MC Hammer and think, yes, that's where I want to be. But also because I saw my dad do it. Even if I was someone's drummer, or even if I was some small part of a group or a collective, that would be enough, because I'd be following him. I've always wanted to do what I saw my dad do. Chapter 17. Wild Child. You can't be weak to overcome this system we are in. You've got to be powerful. Doorway. In those teenage years, we were a crew. I was in Bow, but I used to go over to Limehouse. There was always a crew of us. We used to play football anyway, but then we started going raving. I saw what was happening with Jungle and Garage, and we started to get some ideas. A lot of people were DJing. Scratchy was DJing, Dizzy was too. Everyone was still on the decks. We were into the music our uncles were raving to. More dancehall, more jungle. Early Prodigy, for example. Scratchy and Danny Weed had just finished school, and we started to come together. I was on pirate radio from the age of 14, 15. People used to encourage me, come on, Wiley, let's go on the radio. Come on, Wiley, there's a rave in Bethnal Green. Jump on the mic and I'll give you £30. DJ Slimzy, for example. I think it was Slimzy who took me to my first show. We had to get a train there. I wasn't scared, though. By that stage, I already had loads of A4 notepads filled with lyrics. I could always tell the people who were good. That was my ability. We were friends, first and foremost. It wouldn't have happened if we weren't friends. Those years were very important. They taught me how to help myself, but more importantly, they taught me how to help others. That was the foundation. It was a training ground for what was to come. Maybe I was the training ground. I put time into people, helped them to get to where they needed to go. I was at Ajax. Ajax trained players. It's nuts. They put time into people. They work them hard. And then they sell them. They go on to bigger and better things. And that's what I've done. That's something that no other musician has done. Music is a big business, but I was just helping people. I didn't expect anything for it. I'm not saying I don't get paid, but I get paid for my talent. I don't take anything from them. I don't sell them. I'm like a kung fu master. I helped people, and I don't expect anything for it. The problem is that no one can understand it. Money rules the world. We need it to survive. No one can understand why someone would work, help, spend money, spend time without wanting something for it. But I do get something for it. Maybe I wouldn't have been around for so long if I didn't do it. Chapter 18. Samurai. Dad told me don't follow the herd. Instinct, yes, I follow the word. Can't go wrong. Every boy, when he goes into the world, has to find his own path. People show you stuff, both good and bad, and you need to decide what to do and what not to do. I was very lucky not to go to prison. I knew what drugs were before I got into the game. There's a lot of money in drugs. Anyone who goes into it will find it hard to come out because of the money. That's why people end up in prison. The risks go up as the money goes up. But drugs are not good, and that's it. Don't take drugs. Trust me. I had a DJ friend who was a bit older than me, and he was really good at dealing. Not a gangster, just really good at it. And he pulled me in. We started to make a lot of money. I remember there was one guy who was quite regular. I was showing a new boy the ropes, how to look after the phone, do this, do that. And this guy called up. We go over, and he's got no money, so we're like, what now? And he pulls out a samurai sword. Not a proper one, but a mini one. He started swinging it, walking towards us, so we ran. I thought I was fit, like I could run for long, but this guy didn't stop. He just kept going. We escaped, but didn't really know what we were supposed to do next. So I got a few of the mandem, and we were gonna go find him. But then my boss, the DJ, turned up and said, no, we don't do anything to them, he said, because they will speak. I think he sorted it out somehow. The drug game is a very dangerous game. People got kidnapped, held for 2 weeks under the bed. People getting carjacked. People getting chased down the street. It's just street stuff. Things like that were going on all the time. That world is a bit dark. It can happen for any reason. This one doesn't like that one. If you associate with someone that someone else doesn't like, you can get dragged in. A lot of that happens. The streets are crazy. No matter how bad you are, you can't avoid it. There are no rules. There's no ring, no boxing gloves. It's more dangerous than anything. You can get rushed by 10 man, 20 man, 30 man. You can get shot, stabbed, hit with a hammer, anything. Not just London either. Anywhere. In the end, I had to cross the bridge. I had the record deal. So I moved over to music. I could have kept on going with both, but that would have been greed. I stopped when I was 20, 21. I knew that I could do music.
Chapter 19. SS Crew, Flow Down. I'd known Wiley from 1994, 1995. I used to listen to him on Rinse, him and SS Crew. SS Crew was just a street group, just man them off the roads. People who went to the same school, grew up together. I met him in 1996. I'm from Bow and Poplar, but because I went to school in a different area, our paths never really crossed. I did have run-ins with girls who talked about Wiley and the SS Crew, so I knew they were around. I knew they were close. But I didn't meet him until 1996, when they started at a college that was near my school. So we were like, okay, cool, so you're from Bow, I'm from Bow. We'll be getting the bus to and fro together. And from there, we got to understand that we both like music. And so he had time for me, in that respect. The relationship grew from there. My house was the arena for watching sound system clashes. My parents had a load of videos and we used to watch them again and again. And then we heard the Jungle MCs picking up elements of it. The charisma, the style of delivery, the lyricism. Jungle was a UK twist on that world. Up to that point, there had been a lot of US-influenced music, but Jungle opened our eyes. It made us realise that our accents were allowed. Suddenly, we could be ourselves. We didn't have to try and be anyone else. It made us want to do it. We left college in 1997, and at that time, if you were making music, it was Jungle or drum and bass. Myself, Target, Wiley, loads of people ended up in the Pay As You Go crew, were into Jungle, playing on Rinse, going to shows, that kind of thing. Making music and selling a bit of weed. We were at the stage where we really should have been thinking about what we were doing with our lives. But we weren't, really. Wiley was, though. He would say, right, I'm going to the studio. All of us were like, why? What for? What are you doing there? He'd come back and play us these tunes he'd made, and we'd not really care. But he persevered. He had something different about him. He wasn't the boss, but he was the most looked to, the most sought after. Even then, we had another friend who was a sick producer who did make it in the jungle world. DJ Trend. He helped Wiley. If we were any bigger in terms of selling weed, the music wouldn't have taken off, because the two don't mix. It's impossible to keep them both up.